Hiya and welcome back to the Christian Sport Podcast. It's been a while, but we're back. It's May. The sun is shining, if you're listening to this around now. It's shining where I am. And it's great to be with you. My name's Johnny Reed, and we've got a really great interview today. This week, May 13th to the 19th of May, is Mental Health Awareness Week. And the theme this year is movement. How moving more is important for our mental health. This is what it says on their website. It says, being active is important for our mental health, but so many of us struggle to get enough exercise. And we know there's many different reasons for this. Now, if you listen to Christian Sport Podcast, you may not struggle to get enough exercise, but you're probably well aware of struggles with mental health and also the impact which movement can have on helping us in our mental fitness. So we've got an interview with Heather Lewis. Heather Lewis works at the Mental Health Foundation, which runs the week. But our academic interest in elite sport, she's completed a Master's at St Mary's Twickenham on mental health within the Rugby World Cup context. The Mental Health Foundation exists for those of all faith and none, but she really kindly agreed to speak to us a few weeks ago about her research and about her own personal reflections on her Christian faith and how that plays out in her thinking around mental health and sport. So it's a really insightful, interesting interview with Graham Daniels, our General Director. He sat down in Cardiff a few weeks ago with Heather Lewis. Enjoy.
My guest today is Heather Lewis, who is Project Manager for the Mental Health Foundation. But, of course, the reason she's a guest on this podcast is that her particular focus is on sport. So, Heather, let me get you moving by asking about Mental Health Awareness Week, because we're in it, and that's why we're podcasting. The theme is fascinating. Movement, moving more for our mental health. Tell us a bit about what's going on this week.
Yeah, it's really exciting. So the Mental Health Foundation is the home of Mental Health Awareness Week every year, and we set the theme. So last year it was anxiety, this year's movement, and it's just a really fun one because we're encouraging everyone to move more for their mental health. So there's loads of different activities taking place in like public spaces through to sports stadiums and in the Houses of Parliament as well, just getting people thinking about what kind of movement's good for me, whatever level, and how is that going to help support good mental health.
That's quite a shift, isn't it? Because in contemporary society, I've got no data on this, but I bet you do, people are so much more static than ever before. And for those of us who aren't in the professional world that you're in, I don't suppose I've ever thought about the fact that people don't move as much and it's just not good for you in terms of balance. What's underpinning those changes in society?
Yeah, so the chief medical officer says we should all be moving 150 minutes per week for our physical health, but then it also helps our mental health. And we know that people aren't generally hitting that. And I guess, yeah, I mean, there's a real impact with our jobs, like you say, kind of being sedentary. But also, so for us, we work particularly with people who are at more risk of poor mental health. So people seeking sanctuary, refugees and asylum seekers. If you're on limited access to, say, 30-something pound a week, and then trying to get a gym membership or travel to do sport, that's really hard. Or people who are perhaps care experienced young people, you know, we work a lot with them. How do they access sport and movement? People living in inner cities, is it safe to go out to certain places to move? So there's so many barriers with certain areas of the population on top of then our more sedentary lifestyles.
Fascinating job you have here, Heather, because shortly we'll be coming on to look at what you've done in terms of research with the Rugby World Cup and coaches and players in that, which is the sharp top end of sport. And at the same time, with this Mental Health Awareness Week, we're really talking about the disenfranchised, people who are disenfranchised, disempowered, really.
Yeah.
Would that be a pivotal theme of the work of the foundation?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we're all about prevention and all about trying to work with areas of the population who would be more at risk of poor mental health. And then it's interesting for me then, because even though we don't work with elite athletes, I'm kind of looking at it at that angle and also including, well, perhaps if you're an elite football player, your movement might not be great for your mental health in football all the time. So therefore, what is it? Is it walking the dog, going golf, yoga?
Good.
Does that make sense?
Yes, so, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying, because your day job when you're an elite female or male athlete is fundamentally determined by your fitness.
Yeah.
But actually that can bring more stress in one sense. Oh gosh, what do you recommend to people? Because we'll come on to it again. I've given a hint twice now, but we'll come on to the work you've done with elite sport.
Yeah.
Can we delve a bit further? What are you saying to elite athletes about movement then?
Yeah, I guess it's helping them to recognize. I mean, they'll know. You ask them a question, yes or no. Is it good for your mental health? You know, 9 times out of 10, they're probably going to say, yes, it is. But they probably are thinking, oh, but I just did the bleep test today, or I just did Broncos, or, you know, and they're struggling to think about that. So then it's going, okay, well, when was the last time you enjoyed movement? And it probably was, oh, when I was playing, I don't know, pickleball, or I was doing this, that, or the other. Or take the backroom staff, you talk to them, and if they're up, say they're in a competition or a camp, they're up at 6, they're, you know, everyone wants them all the time to fix stuff. They're treating through to the end of the day. So they'll say, oh, I've got to get my half an hour walk in, or my gym session, or my movement at the start of the day, because that helps set my physical and mental health. So it's basically just asking them, drawing it out of them, and then passing that gold dust on to other people.
Fascinating. What got you into this job? I mean, this is some vision that you have here. How did you get started?
So I've always grown up playing sport, being in a family that loves sport. And then I'm a youth worker by background, so that's what I did as my first degree. And then I worked in what was called a boys' behavioural school. You wouldn't call it that now, but I loved it. Like, I had rocks thrown at my head, and one day my car wouldn't start, and the boys were like, it's okay, miss, we can jump start your car for you, and we know how to hotwire it. And, like, I just loved it. What's funny is my dad was the school police officer, so that, you know, I didn't really want them to know about that, but they did. Thankfully, he had a good reputation. So I was like, how do I earn respect with these boys? Because I'm a woman at the time in my mid-20s, and so I play netball, and I'm, you know, not brilliant, but the fact that I could get a ball in through the basketball net without it touching the backboard, they were like, oh, we respect you. So I think early on I began to understand the power of sport, so the sport for development space. Does that make sense?
Yeah, lots of sense. Yeah, so you're young in that setting. What's your next step career wise from there?
Yeah, so after that I went and did like a youth pastor role in churches, and again, youth sport all the time, and actually had to work harder at connecting with the young people that sport wasn't their passion. So I did that. So there was still that kind of care pastoral investing in people, you know, in that situation as well. And from that then spent some time working at Christians in Sport, which really then helped to pull things together, particularly from that elite end of understanding elite sport a little bit more, and an opportunity then to go and do some chaplaincy through that.
Yeah, that's quite a trajectory, isn't it? You've developed as a professional woman almost simultaneously with the increasing awareness of the relationship between physical and mental well-being, and in particular the development of the whole understanding of the lack of mental health in this country. Well, that's fair, isn't it? Your career has been simultaneous with that emergence. Yeah. When did you first really become aware of the mental health dynamic of people's lives as a young youth worker, say?
I think probably when I was 18 even. I worked at an inner city school in Newport, and seeing some of the children, the young people, so they would have been year 7, 11, 12 coming in, and just all of the things that were going on in their home life and then the struggles. So how are they going to sit down and do their spellings, their maths, etc., when they were just had low mood, when they were anxious, when they hadn't eaten that morning, you know, all of that kind of thing. I think that's probably when I first had my eyes opened to kind of poor mental health, really. And then the more I understood about professional sport, I guess, I then began to see similar kind of, you know, high anxiety levels or low mood or in that world. And then the more I've studied and understood, I'm like, you know, physical health, mental health, they're intertwined, and there are things we can do to prevent poor mental health, but it's really important and it matters. And how can I play my role in it?
So at the moment, you've given us an insight into young boys at school in really difficult situations. I can't see a mark of a rock on your head anywhere. You must have got your hands up. And then you work at the very, very top end of elite sport, particularly in rugby. Let's talk about those people in the middle, because a lot of people listening to our podcast will be, as you described yourself earlier, netballer, keen sportswoman, train a couple of times, play once a week. I'm working on the premise that there's a very nice balance, generally speaking, of mental good health if you're in that environment.
Yeah, I think that kind of, you know, if you can be playing sport and in a community and it's regular and you've got people around you that you build relationship with and are trusted and you have the social aspect, there's so many good factors for good mental health there. So it's like you're doing one thing but benefiting from four or five things at once.
Well, draw them out for us, because pretty much all of us who do that don't really stop to think about it because we've done it since we're kids.
Yeah.
Draw some of those benefits out that make them obvious.
Yeah. So we know, Mental Health Foundation, we've gone through, because there's so many top tips out there for mental health. So we've done this kind of research piece, what are the evidence-based top tips? And so some of them would be being around people, being sociable, being in that kind of community where you're known and you're interacting with people. So that is good for our mental health, that social connectedness. And then, you know, that movement and physical activity is good. And if it's outside as well, nature benefits our mental health too. So that's even better. And then I guess if you're volunteering in a club or that kind of role, kindness and being kind of supportive of others, we know evidence-based is good for your mental health. And then learning something new is also good for your mental health. So if you can get a week where you're doing those things, learning a new drill, being around people, helping out, those kinds of things, they're all good for you, for your mental health.
Let's touch on your own Christian faith here. As a professional woman at the Mental Health Foundation, as each of us, you'd start from your own perspective. You've had a lifelong Christian faith. How do you say that has a bearing or a perspective on what you've learnt about physical and mental health over these years?
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think a lot of times when I read things or I'm delivering training to people, so often, you know, for me as a Christian, the Bible is the book, I believe it's God's word, that kind of tells me who he is, who he's made me to be, how the world kind of functions. And it'll pop into my mind like, oh yeah, the Bible talks about that kind of aspect, like being kind towards one another, or the Bible talks about, you know, it talks about our emotions in so many ways. And so I find that really interesting and really encouraging as well, that I see that. I see the science and the evidence base, but then I see that in my faith and understanding who I believe God is and who he's made me to be and how I relate to people in that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, because we all start with a worldview, a perspective of some kind. So I'm imagining there's a great encouragement as you articulate that in seeing, particularly through your research, as well as your experience, evidence that the premise of what God says in the Bible is a good premise for what you experience in everyday life, right?
Yeah.
Let's turn that then to the elite side now. Your master's degree, your master's research fascinates me, and I think for those listening to us, it'll be quite an insight. Here's the title of it, The Lived Experience of Mental Health Within a Rugby World Cup Context. Now, had you gone with any other second clause, we might not be quite so compelled to listen to this, but this is people who are actually involved in Rugby World Cups, men or women, who are the recipients or the participants in your research. Before we delve into the data and what you found, give us a feel of the kind of people who are the participants.
Yeah, so I was able to talk to participants from 10 different countries, and I was able to talk to tier one nations and tier two nations, which is really helpful because tier two nations, they would have less resource, other kind of challenges as well. So that was really helpful. And like you say, I was able to talk to men and women. And what I was very thankful for was that people who didn't make it to the Rugby World Cup were willing to talk to me. So people who had done that whole, probably for some of them, nearly a four-year cycle, they'd been in the pre-training camp and then they didn't make the cut for the last, I think it's 35, to then go to the Rugby World Cup. So there was a real mix, and there were players and then also a handful of backroom staff as well, who were, you know, various kind of, say, medical roles or, like, analysts or, you know, those kinds of roles, but not head coaches, didn't speak to them.
Okay. And just one more prelim to some depth on this. What give us a feel of one or two of the questions that you'd have asked, the open-ended questions that helped you to collect evidence from these range of people.
Yeah, they were really simple questions that gave absolute gold dust because people just were willing to open up. And they, you know, I asked, okay, what is most helpful for your mental health in the Rugby World Cup competition itself context? Off they go. And then I'm able to adapt and ask other questions. And then, for example, what are the most vulnerable times or circumstances for you as a player, physio or whatever, during a Rugby World Cup context? What advice would you give to a future X, Y or Z? So, yeah, those were some of the questions.
Yeah, I've had the privilege of reading some of it, and the way that you seems to me very cleverly look at pre-competition, during competition and post-competition is really broad and helpful. What surprised you the most? Because you don't know what you're going to get back when you ask these questions. You don't know what themes will emerge. What surprised you the most as a person?
I think from a kind of social perspective, that people who I'd never met before were willing to open up and to talk about their lived experience. And this bit didn't surprise me because they're very generous in wanting others to learn from their lived experience, but therefore that they were like, if this can help one person, if what I share can do this. And so they were, yeah, just so open. And of course, I don't know them to know if they told me everything. Probably not, but their openness really surprised me.
And look, I like the fact that you are an optimist by nature. We've known each other a long time. So your glass is always half full. And that is a lovely comment about the positivity of it. But you've got pretty vast experience of the difficulties of mental health that you've observed in people. Was there anything that actually weren't expecting about the difficulties that these backroom staff and players faced?
I think probably the lack of resource. So on one level, that didn't surprise me because of roles I've done before. But in some circumstances, there was a real lack of resource to even have a conversation about mental health amongst some kind of communities, and that varied from different to different kind of countries and setups. But yeah, that just left me feeling a bit sad, I guess, because I was like, oh, this is simple. There are some simple fixes potentially here.
In professional football, lots of the data continues to show, so it's football, that sports psychology is still underrepresented in the game, still. And secondly, there remains a tension point between the performance requirements of the sports psych, which is their job. It's to get the performance right on the weekend, as it were. And what for probably 30 years now has been a chaplaincy role. You've performed both. Well, you've certainly been a chaplain at a good level of rugby, and now you're not there as a sports psych, you're there as a researcher in that sense, and to bring well-being. Can you talk into that for us a little bit, that how that works inside rugby?
Yeah, exactly that emerged, as you know from your experience, that there is a tension between what a player needs when it comes to their mental health and well-being and then what can be offered through a sports psych. Mm. And now that's not the case. It really varies from country to country. So some countries won't have a sports psych full-time, let alone then mental health and well-being or chaplaincy or whatever. And then some will have sports psych who, as you say, are there for your performance, but then there can be a lack of... Can I talk? Can I be vulnerable about my mental health and well-being? Because will that then impact upon my performance? And what role is this person playing for me? And again, depending on the level of sport, so some players would talk about, oh, in my club, as opposed to like my country, you know, I'm just not sure that it would all be entirely confidential, because ultimately psychology is there to help me with my kicking or my performance or whatever. So there's that, like, where will this information go and how will I be perceived? So there's that vulnerability already in a heightened experience. Mm. But conversely, some people talked very encouraged, you know, with great encouragement about good mental health and well-being support. And so it's really important to acknowledge that and not paint it all as bleak and bad, you know?
Yeah. So how would you now, in hindsight, having done some of this research, what role, at its best, then, the differentiation between the sports chaplain or the well-being officer or player welfare officer? Mm. Lots of synonyms for this.
Yeah.
There are secular versions, effectively, and there's a Christian or religious version, certainly of sports chaplaincy. At their best, how do these things coordinate the care of a player?
So within the various different kind of systems around them, that coordination. I guess it's clarity, isn't it? Like, this is who I am. This is my role. This is stay in my lane. I'm confidential here. And this person takes care of that. And I think clarity just brings greater trust and it enables somebody to know, okay, I'm talking to you about this thing and not necessarily that. And that's what, you know, someone said to me in their research was like, I have got so many competing voices coming into me that I don't need another voice. So I think that clarity of role, and I guess it comes all the way back to a policy level, doesn't it, from a setup, is, okay, have we got all bases covered here? Sports psych, nutrition, S&C, strength and conditioning, et cetera. So all the way back from a policy perspective, you then get that clarity, resource, et cetera, ready for then when that player, coach is in that environment, it's good to go. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So in the light of that then, let's look at some recommendations, because you get the opportunity now in your professional life to speak to pretty important bodies, governing bodies of sport, players' unions, into government. If you were to highlight two or three of the key recommendations that you would be making and have made from your work, what do you say to people? What do you recommend?
That the player and the backroom staff, whoever that participant is in the Rugby World Cup context, that their voice and their lived experience is the most important. So allowing that voice to speak and to influence change is really important.
What do people need to do? Sorry to interrupt there, because these findings now, the last part of our conversation, and I hope they're interesting to our listeners, because it really is good research, this. All right. What's going to happen for the player's voice and the coach's voice or the backroom voice to be heard? Why isn't it being heard?
I guess because in elite sport, there is that vulnerability of being honest. If you talk about mental health, there's still some stigma attached to it, isn't there, in the general public population, let alone then in an elite sport environment. So there's that challenge of kind of being vulnerable and talking about how you're doing. So that's kind of a barrier. I guess the high turnover of players and again the staff around them. I guess there's cultural differences, language differences, etc. that can make it really varied between which nation you're representing. So therefore, I think one of the most helpful things I talked about in my research was what's been done around concussion. Well, if that can get done, you know, from a policy level all the way through and owned and resourced financially, so it doesn't matter what nation you're representing, this is the standard, this is what we're dealing with, it empowers people then, because the systems are in place to make sure that it's done well. So therefore, if there is that co-production of the voices and the systems coming together, I think that can really influence.
So in order for those policy changes, that's very helpful analogy, because even non-rugby people will now know that there's a very robust policy on concussion across the board, and there's no escaping it. Your report, your work and your reporting now, here's a list of some of the people: players' associations, governing bodies, host nations, policy creators. I mean, you're speaking to pretty influential people now. So what are you saying to them?
Yeah, I guess it's celebrating what's already been done well in the Rugby World Cup context. And then acknowledging that and saying, okay, what can be learnt from what's being done well in the light of here's what I've heard from these individuals and what they're endorsing is good, but then where are the gaps? So how can we take what's being done well, learn from what is being said, and kind of merge those together? And I think that if you get the insight of a person who says, what my lived experience is, my reality is not what then matches up with how things are portrayed, that's quite powerful, isn't it? To say,
very powerful.
We need this help, we need this support, etc.
Now, tricky for you to answer this in the public square. What's the response like? We're on a scale, aren't we? You can have token responses to your research and the body you represent, through to dead serious, we're going to fix it. What are the vibes you're getting, if you're able to tell us?
Yeah, it's so new. Like, I only graduated a couple of weeks ago. But when I have spoken to people who are in a similar field to me, especially people, you know, that overlapping Venn diagram of they've been a professional rugby player and they're now working in academics or they're working in some kind of policy role, they're like, Heather, this is gold dust. We want to help you. We want to get this out there. And I don't think I realized how rich and new it was. I went after this research because I knew it hadn't been done before. So that's been really encouraging. And those people have been so generous then in linking me in with other people. And what has been really encouraging that's come back is, oh, you've spoken to 10 different nationalities. So it's only a small pool of people, but we're not just talking about, say, the Six Nations teams anymore or just the Southern Hemisphere. So that has then given me more kudos and that space for them to listen and go, okay, let's see what we can do with this, and is there potential to then build on it? It'll take time to see what action comes, because, you know, you've got to see if that action kind of matches that investment, but it looks quite encouraging so far.
Gosh, and it now feels like there's quite a weight on your shoulders, because when you do research like this, I mean, here's what's hard. Very few people could get to speak to these elite players and backroom staff. So it's very hard to get the data. And even if you can speak to them, if they don't trust you, you're not going to get the full story from them. You've managed to do that. So that alignment with people who have played in the game, coached, backroom staffed in the game, and are now at governing body levels as well. Seriously, that's quite a demand on you. I mean, because this is pioneering research. So how are you going to advance this? Because you've got to make policy and you've got to keep driving the research data. How are you going to do that?
I guess coming back to the faith aspect of this, I think as a Christian, knowing and believing that God's made me, that he's given me gifts, that he's given me a support network around me and people that would cheerlead me, hold me to account, support me, pray for me, help me, that's a huge encouragement to me in this work. This is like, when I think, was it 2016 or something, was when I started doing chaplaincy work. This is not quick. everything takes time. It's perseverance, it's knockbacks, it's being dropped even as a chaplain, you know, all of these things that you just have to trust the process and trust, like for me, trusting God's faithfulness and seeing him bring things to fruition over time as well. So not expecting quick wins. And then I think finally having the voices of those people who I spoke to, you know, such a privilege, them saying, if this can help one person, if this can do this, that reminds me, and many of them have given me permission to keep them in the loop about where this goes. So being able to drop them a message and say, hey, actually, this has got beyond my master's, where three people read it, to I'm now having these meetings, that also helps me to keep going because I want to advocate on their behalf. Yeah.
Well, it's a tremendous vision, this. I mean, it really is. I'd quite like to dig in a little bit to your autobiography there.
Okay.
Brackets, we may or may not use it.
Okay.
And you'll have to decide on that. But inevitably, when you say, gosh, 8 years' work, and that's building on your previous life experience, obviously, but 8 years since you went to be chaplain to the Welsh women's rugby team.
Yeah, yeah.
Walk through in a bit more detail your lived experience of this window of 8 years. Talk us through that window in a bit more detail.
Yeah, so I did that chaplaincy role in two parts because there was a turnover of coaches and different things, and you know what elite sport's like. And so there was that, and then coming away from that and thinking, okay, how can I play a role beyond this? And so I went and trained myself up as an elite athlete lifestyle advisor, and I did a course at St. Mary's Twickenham with that. And you know when you're in a room and you're learning theory and you're like, oh, this is what I've been doing, this is me, this is what I love to do, you know, that was so exciting. And so only working voluntarily with a handful of people and supporting them in that role, and then transitioning then to the Mental Health Foundation and being in those rooms and learning from those people. And then just having a brilliant line manager that talked me into what I thought was a module in mentoring. And then I ended up doing a master's. And again, people along the way who've then given me, you know, said, this is Heather, we know her, we trust her. Would you help her with her research? People, you know, they call it a snowball effect in research. So once I've spoken to one person and they're like, all right, she's okay, they would then say, oh, speak to this person or that person. So I guess as I reflect on what you've just asked, it's a process of time of kind and generous people supporting, encouraging and helping me, and me learning along the way, and making mistakes too, but as I go.
Heather, when you sit down with elite athletes, they're face to face with you. How do you get them talking? What are they talking about? Unpack for us what this a woman that you meet with would really be going through at the elite end for those of us who wouldn't understand it. And how do you handle it?
Yeah, I guess it comes back down to trying to build trust and have an integrity and being clear on who you are and what your role is. You know, that's really helpful, and it takes time, and sharing appropriately part of, you know, yourself and who you are, so that you are building that relationship, because sport's all about power. And so there can be a real power dynamic then. And actually in that role, there isn't a power dynamic. And I think that really helps as well. I'm not there to select that person, deselect them or anything. I'm separate. So that making that clear helps.
Yes.
And I think then you then get people being honest then over time and saying, okay, I'm really struggling actually with the pressure from not just the coach or, you know, the other team members, but the expectation perhaps from my family or, you know, from my friends. And they've given up so much to support me in this situation, and I haven't been on the socials. I missed my friend's 21st, I missed my friend's 30th, and then I haven't even made the squad to get on the plane to go. So there's those kinds of things, you know, and it's listening and supporting and encouraging them, and where necessary then signposting on when you know that isn't my bag. As a lifestyle advisor, I'm going to signpost you to this person who I trust and we know that does good work as well.
I'm assuming these are long-term relationships often, because you're not selected to go. I mean, whoever outside of the person not selected or their family ever thinks about the person who didn't make the cut when the event's on. So you tend to stay in the room, I'm assuming. How do you stay in the room longer term? How do you make those decisions? Or when somebody's injured, has to retire, is there a formula for that? How do you do it?
Me walking alongside them still.
Yeah,
I guess it's on their terms, and it's kind of saying, I'm here to support you. I think something that I try and really make clear is I want to be the one person in your life that there's no expectation that if you don't reply to my WhatsApp for 4 weeks, that's okay. Because there is this, like, what do I wear? Where do I go? When should I be? Media, all that stuff. And so I don't want to be another one of those people. And so I think that really helps as well, that they can just pick up with you in 6 months' time and catch up from where you were. And for some people, you might not hear from them again because they just wanted one catch up, one walk. They didn't want anyone to know about it. And for others, it's years and years of just touching base and catching up, which is a real privilege.
Yeah, surely. Thinking about, let's think, I know your research doesn't talk to coaches, but other backroom staff, but I'm going to posit something for you. If you're a coach of a competitive sports team, not elite, so that pressure that elite sport brings, international sport brings, isn't there. But it's got its degree of pressure, of leadership, and a squad of people where you have to leave people out, where people get injured, where you're constantly making choices. In the light of your learnings about good mental health, what might you be saying to a coach to give them the best chance of serving their team?
Yeah, really good. I've been thinking about this recently with a resource I've been writing. And actually, so first of all, for the coach themselves, have they got people that support them around them? Are they thinking about their mental health, their well-being? Have they got trusted people? I think secondly, again, clarity and communication. So is there a way that you announce the squad consistently all the time? And do you know your resource and your capacity for then following up? Because if that's clear when the pressure's off pre-season, hey everyone, this is how I announce my squad. This is the amount of time I have. People are forewarned. It's not then reactive, it's proactive. Does that make sense? So like one of the things I heard back was like players saying, 1 week we found out via WhatsApp, the next week we had a meeting, and it was just really hard to know. So I think that communication piece and clarity is mega helpful. Then if you have the luxury, it's getting to know your players as individuals and how different they are. So an exercise I did when I was with one under 18 squad, I was given such trust by the coach and they allowed me to do a session, and I just did a one-pager infographic, and one of the questions on it was, when you're feeling stressed because of rugby, what's the most helpful thing to you and what's the least helpful thing to you? So me and all the coaches had that at the start of the season then. So we know, you know, everyone's different. For me, I love to talk things out and go for a coffee. But for another person, they'll be like, don't talk to me for 24 hours. And so if you know that, you can respond.
Well, Heather, after a pretty comprehensive discussion about your work and your vision, you've mentioned your own faith in passing all the way through at various points. What's the bedrock relationship between your Christian faith and this vision and vocation that you have?
Yeah, I think my understanding of who God is, who he's made me to be, and the way that I can play my part in the work that I do and the relationships I have is really important. And there's a part of the Bible that talks about speaking up for those who have no voice. So I love that because I see that in both my Mental Health Foundation work, where we get to advocate during Mental Health Awareness Week to millions and millions. But then also when I get to be in rooms supporting coaches to think about those children and young people who've had adverse childhood experiences, how they can be a positive role model, through to then still advocating for elite sports people who the world might think they've got everything, but actually they can't always advocate for themselves because their voice is under pressure. So I think that ability, to live out my faith in that way, to advocate, is really encouraging and really challenging for me as well.
Well, Heather Lewis, two things come out of this for me as the interviewer. Number one, the quality of the work that you've been privileged to undertake. And God willing, there's plenty more work to come.
Yeah.
And plenty more assistance to the elite athletes that you'll work with. And two, the incredible grasp of the vocation you've been given as a Christian woman, that this is a God-given vocation to serve the world of elite sport. It's a very lovely thing. It's been a pleasure interviewing you today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much to Heather. Thank you for her time. And I really hope you enjoyed listening to that as much as I did. Real food for thought and really interesting to reflect on and to put into practice as we think through our own mental health, but also those of those around us in our sports clubs and teams. So I hope you found that interesting as I did. One thing we just wanted to flag to you as we finish this podcast is Christians in Sport have released this amazing Summer of Sport, a sports mission pack. It's full of everything you need as a church or as an individual to reach sports people with the gospel this summer. It's an exciting summer of sport. We've got quizzes around the football and around the Olympics. We've got a few evangelistic films we've created, looking and reflecting on the story of Eric Liddell. It's 100 years since Eric Liddell competed in Paris and famously spoke up of his faith at that time. So some interesting reflections on that. There's guides for running a Sunday service. There's things for schools with assemblies and lessons. There's so much which you can find in the Sports Mission Pack. We've also written a short book and tract, which you can buy from 10 of those, again, looks at the story of Eric Liddell, and you could hand it out in your community. Maybe give that to everybody at your sports club or team. Loads of ways of making the most of those resources. They're really cheap, and you can find them at 10 of those on their website. So loads of things in the Sports Mission Pack. We'd love you to get involved and make the most of it. But we hope you really enjoy this podcast. We'll see you again soon. Take care. Bye-bye.